Hello and welcome to K9 Bingequake, a show about the forgotten Doctor Who spinoff, where we don't let our guests watch the rest of it so they can check us on how far deep into Stockholm Syndrome we are. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Tom.
I'm Molly.
Hey!
Welcome to the show, Molly, and you are the host of a very, very good Doctor Who podcast. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that before we dive in?
Yeah, so I host a podcast called Galactic Yo-Yo, although I haven't... This year's been a quiet year for it. Generally, the premise of it is supposed to be guests come to me with their unpopular Doctor Who opinions, although in the last year or so, we've just been kind of reviewing the episodes that have been airing. That's been going for about 5 years now, maybe nearly six. That's my podcast.
And it's brilliant stuff. If anyone listening to this hasn't checked it out, you should.
And Kevin, you've appeared on it.
Yes, once upon a time.
And so obviously, you know, you hadn't had your fill of unpopular opinions enough. You had to come and talk about a deeply unpopular show as well.
Exactly.
Which is what you're doing here. One thing we like to start off by asking people is, you know, how aware were you of the K9 show? What did you know about it? Did you have any preconceptions before agreeing to this?
Sure. So I knew it existed. I knew the ins and outs of the copyright situation. And I knew the sort of vague premise. I knew that it was Australian, but it was ostensibly set in London. And I'd seen, I think, some stills from it, but I'd never seen any footage from it. And that is it. That's all I knew.
Cool. I think that, yeah, that's probably the case with most fans and most of our guests at this point. Yeah. So episode 5 then, Sirens of Ceres. And we were just discussing before we started recording that I get the sense, and I, you know, not quite got to the bottom of this yet, but I get the sense that although this seemed like a step up in many ways for Kevin myself, we thought this was quite a good one compared to the previous four. And I immediately thought, this probably doesn't come across that way if you're watching it in isolation. You have not seen the previous four, in which case it probably just maybe doesn't look very good. What were your first impressions, Molly, of Sirens of Ceres?
So I guess production value-wise, I didn't find it. It was exactly as I'd imagined. And I don't know, I struggled to get a handle on who the characters were and why they knew each other and how it was all connected. I understood pretty quickly that there was a sort of totalitarian government. Wasn't really sure how the kids knew the professor and why, how they knew each other. And yeah, I thought the acting was appalling throughout. And the story was pretty predictable. It felt very workmanlike, is the way that I would describe it. Sorry if this is too negative.
No, it's all right. Just, no. You know, crushing our hopes and dreams.
We've been worse.
We have definitely seen worse.
We have said much worse.
It was like the Sarah Jane Adventures if you ordered it from Wish. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. No, I think this episode in particular really lends itself to being that, because this is a very much sort of school mystery of the week story, mm-hmm. which actually this show hasn't really done yet. So for us, that was really refreshing. And it's very formulaic. It's very predictable. There's not a single trope in this you haven't seen before.
I mean, even in Doctor Who, like it was quite school reunion in places.
It's very school reunion.
Yes, very.
Yeah.
It's a weird one because, as you were saying, Molly, the setup of the sort of fascist regime, future London kind of thing, previously that's been taken in sort of all sorts of weird directions with kind of dissidents on the run and running through the sewers and all this sort of stuff, but in a way that feels very unreal. You know, just kind of how do these characters really relate to each other? It's not been very kind of well fleshed out. And so one thing that's been working so far better than almost anything else in the show for Kevin and myself has been that Georgie, who's sort of the main character, sort of foreground in this one, has kind of more of a real life than the other characters, or more of a home life. Now, I realise that's very sort of bare bones of, you know, how TV should work, but that does feel like the high bar of the characterisation at this point. Would you agree, Kevin?
Yes, I would agree, but let's just play this pop quiz since we played it on a few guests now. Who are the characters, Molly?
Right, so you've got Georgie, and she's sort of the main character in this episode. I'm not sure whether that's true of the other episodes. You've got the boy. He's got a name that sounds like a surname.
Starkey, yeah.
Starkey, yes. Then there's the Professor Griffin, I think he's called.
Yep, very good.
I did Google the names of the characters.
That's cheating.
There's Georgie's mum, and she is some kind of civil servant, I guess. And then there is the protester who goes to the school with her. Was she just in this episode?
She is just in this episode.
She's our first actual person of color in this whole damn thing.
She is.
Yes, I did think that, actually. And then there's also that other boy who I was like, "Where? Who's this guy?" when he showed up, and I had to have a look on Wikipedia to check who he was, and it turns out he's a regular cast member as well.
He always feels like that.
And he's had the most successful acting career since.
Yeah. I love that you placed him below the guest character of the protest.
Well, he makes less of an impression in this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's just a
there's K-9, of course, K-9.
And there's K-9, who's also...
He's also kind of an afterthought in this one.
Yeah, he doesn't do much in this episode.
Which I tend to think makes it... I actually kind of prefer it when he's not around, ironically. I know obviously he is the main point, but he's becoming increasingly grating in the way that they write him on the show.
Yes, so. Like his little line at the beginning about, is that something people usually do? No. Oh, then there's police brutality happening. That was way too cheery. That was not okay.
It was odd. It was just, it's hard to write those kinds of characters, isn't it? And I feel like in Star Wars, it's quite hit and miss the way they do these sort of cheeky robots. Mm. And in Doctor Who, I feel like in the Graham Williams era, they did quite a good job with K-9 because he's like just dry enough, but he was too peppy in this.
Someone was saying to me the other day that they think it might be because I think it's Dave Martin of the duo who wrote the character in the 70s. It was him who wrote K-9 as like a sort of, quote marks, tribute to his dog who died.
Right, and
it was like, he created K-9 out of kind of, sort of love for his own dog. And it's kind of, not to be too harsh on Bob Baker, but, ever since then, it's been Bob Baker who's been trying to sort of make K-9 a kind of commercial thing. And it does feel a little bit like that original sort of soul of the characters has been lost somewhere along the way. But anyway,
I would agree. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Bob Baker's no longer with us, right?
No, he isn't anymore.
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we can say what we like about his programming.
That's true.
Oh dear.
So yeah, those are the main characters, though. That's a nice summary.
To give you a quick rundown, Molly, so you can understand the rest of our conversation. Yeah. Starkey, the boy, is the main character of the show. K-9 regenerated, saving his life. He is a protester. Georgie is also a protester who joined him. And she is, by all accounts, more competent, but for some reason is not the one everyone's focused on.
Right. Because she's a girl, probably, I think. Mm.
Yes. Also, incidentally, we're talking about her having the most developed relationships. There is very naturally, as you've seen here, a love triangle.
Yeah, a love triangle between him,
Darius, and Starkey for some unknown reason.
But she sort of seems to like Starkey more, although that's not really been that kind of come to the fore for a while. But
I didn't pick up on that really. I picked up on her dynamic with Starkey, but not with the other guy.
Yeah, he's not really in it much. I guess she sort of gets his hopes up in quote marks at the end, doesn't she? Because she does that flirting with him at the end, and he's. But, and there's also a love triangle with this other character.
Right. Yes. Of course. The guest character. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the characters.
And this week you didn't have to deal with any of them.
Yeah, you're the real winner. One thing we should say is actually Georgie's mum. June is she's kind of a civil servant, but that makes her sound a bit more banal than I think her role really is, which is that she is like a key cog in the sort of the running of the fascist authoritarian government. I think there is a genuinely possible compelling setup there of, what do you do if you want to be a dissident but your mother is essentially running the regime?
Yeah,
you know, sure. I think there's a good idea there.
And of course, this episode gets a lot of the plot out of her interdepartmental squabbles with that blonde dude who basically wants to get power over.
Oh, this is like the main villain guy.
Drake. Yeah. Oh, he's terrible. Drake. He's so bad.
Yes.
I think he's the worst actor of the lot, to be honest.
I was going to say
you're right, yes.
Yeah, I think the acting is like bad across the board. I think his acting is some of the worst acting I've ever seen on television. Actually, all the kids were kind of fine. Like, it was kids' TV acting, but it was adequate.
Yeah.
I actually think all the adults were the worst actors. Like, even the professor, like, is not a good actor.
Yeah. I think of the adults, Georgie's mom is the only one that's been compelling for me.
Reasonable. And the accents are completely dreadful.
Yes.
Yeah, Georgie most of the time nails it, actually, as does Starkey. Again, it's the adults. There's one moment where Georgie says, like, one word that is just completely Australian. Like, just completely Australian, completely took me out of it. But, why is it set in London?
It's
baffling,
isn't it?
Why not just set it in Australia?
It's wish.com. It's the wish.com.
Yes, I guess so.
It's the wish.com London.
It's like it has to be sort of somehow connected into all that cool Britannia. Yeah, it's.
But they made no effort to make it, you know, to make it seem like London. Even
it was made, pretty much made in a shed in Brisbane, so no wonder in a way it doesn't look like London. But
that's true.
But still,
that's true.
Yeah, I was just staring at the white background walls in the school, thinking, oh, if they had any money, it would not look like that whatsoever.
Yeah, it was very low budget.
I think this might even have been the cheapest episode so far in some ways.
I
suspect it was.
Because there's no prosthetics, there's no monsters, there's no aliens, there's not much in the way of CG or effect or anything, whereas previous ones have.
Well, there's K-9, and I thought that was interesting, because they use a combination of CG and real effects, don't they, for K-9? Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Although, when K-9's flying and he's CGI... I noticed they'll try and minimise the amount of shots of him. There's a lot of shots where he's talking and he's off screen. And if it were any other character, we'd be looking at them. But because it's K-9 and it's too expensive to show him again, we're looking at the other characters and we're hearing K-9. Did you guys notice this? It was particularly in the start, in the police scene. K-9 was doing a lot of off-screen talking, and I think that was because they couldn't afford the shots of... flying CGI K-9, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
This feels like a good
we
moment
to mention. We
want to
dive into that police scene because it's probably the most deep scene in this whole thing.
I mean, yeah, this is definitely the first spin-off that opens on, you know, explicit police brutality against a person of colour who's a protesting police violence. Like, that does fit. When you describe it like that, it sounds great. You know, or it sounds like one of the, you know, most sort of politically charged things in the entire sort of universe, but
tepid, a bit tepid.
Yeah, I mean, I find it quite a striking or sort of arresting arresting pun unintended visual to sort of open with. But yeah, it's I mean, it's been a running thing of kind of, you know, these cybernetic police units sort of chasing people down, but this is the first one that sort of, I suppose, stages a bit of a, you know, okay, very brief, but a bit of a debate about what the right course of action is to sort of respond to that. So obviously you've got one character who thinks, right, the thing to do is to film it and publicize it and, you know, show people the truth and all this, which turns out to be massively ineffective because they just smash his camera. And Georgie's thing is to throw a rock at them, basically. Which also doesn't do very much, but it seems to be shown as, I think, the better approach of the two. I don't know.
I think there's a complicated handling of Georgie in this episode where
I
don't think the show has hinted this before, but in this episode, it sort of shows her as a sort of disaffected rich kid who is protesting, not because it's right necessarily, though that is a motivating factor, but also because it's part of teenage rebellion, which I think it makes her a more interesting character, but I also think it makes the show more politically muted.
The show recognizes her privilege, doesn't it? Yeah. There's that line about, you know, oh, tough day at private school was the worst day of your life, big deal, you know, which I thought was quite good.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it would be being too generous to see this as some kind of genuine comment on or commentary on police brutality. I mean, it seemed more to me like a pastiche of dystopian science fiction. Like, I don't think it was like thinking about what it was saying politically. The source material was, you know, 1984 and so on and so forth. But yeah. this episode is just mimicking better science fiction that happens to have those politics. You know, it's not as if the writers of this were really thinking about police brutality. It was just, oh well, we're making a pastiche of this kind of science fiction, so we've got to include it. You know, brutalistic robot police force.
But I will say, if you gotta go out for pastiche and pastiche something, and it's gonna accidentally give you surprisingly decent politics, I'm here for it.
I'm okay. Yeah, no, it's not really a criticism. I guess I'm just doing a bit of excavation.
Yeah, and it is an interesting impulse to marry that sort of, as you're saying, kind of 1984 sort of world with essentially sort of Mean Girls or St. Trinians, which is kind of what the rest of the episode is doing, of saying, you know, the school is a sort of microcosm for the kind of oppressive state. Again, I'm probably sort of taking this a bit far in terms of the analysis, but you know what I mean?
You know what better show it stumbles on by doing that? It's basically the Demon Headmaster reboot from recent times.
Yes, I would agree. Yeah, it is. It is similar to that.
Yes, just it's trying to do it in only one sort of 23-minute episode or whatever, so it's got to sort of wrap it all up at the end and then move on to the next thing. With the whole kind of, you know, children under control with these creepy bracelets and all that stuff. It's a, you know, tapping into the same idea of school is where, you know, indoctrination happens and all this kind of thing.
So we get a plot I mean, we've all seen this plot before where all the kids are brainwashed to become perfect students. And I like the touch that they all become hotter as a result with better hair. That was very funny to me, but...
A creepy catwalk sachet.
Yeah, yes. That was odd.
There were some good lines in this one. I have to give a shout-out to the writer. This was the first script she's done. I've just forgotten her name, but she is the first woman we've had write for this show.
Yeah, Deborah Parsons.
Deborah Parsons, yeah. Yes. And it had some fantastic dialogue.
Georgie had that line about...
Yes. Oh, yes. She asks if the guilt trip's going to be long and if she should pack a bag. I would...
Yes. So I'm going to start using that.
Yes. It was great.
Very funny indeed.
It did have a few good lines. Yeah. Yeah. And it's no surprise that she, Deborah Parsons, has been doing TV since the 1980s, whereas some of the other writers who... done this show, this was like almost their first thing.
Yes, and I was very pleased to look on Wikipedia and see she'll be back, so we might have some refreshingly competent writing in future. So
did Bob Baker write any of this stuff? Like
I think he might do a few later down the road, but
okay, fine,
but none, you know, for a good stretch. Yeah, he's kind of involved in the development, but then or sort of in the creation of the series, but then in the actual sort of day-to-day running of it, I don't know how much he did.
Yeah, there's very few people who are actually familiar names to Doctor Who involved in this whatsoever, I would say. Which is
But one of them did direct the episode. Which
oh, really?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we, was that what you were building up to there, Kevin?
Yes, it was.
Sorry. So Daniel Netheim, who is the really quite good Capaldi-era director of... Yes. The Zygon two-parter and Extremis and Pyramid at the End of the World.
Right.
He's got a great CV. He's got, you know, he did like, is it the Modern Humans with Gemma Chan, and he did Broadchurch series 3, and he's done that film The Hunter with Willem Dafoe. Like a lot of good stuff. And he's done K-9.
So this was like an early career thing for him.
I think so.
Is he Australian?
He is Australian, yes. So that does explain.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Doctor Who fans will stoop to do anything to do Doctor Who.
Yeah, I kind of forgot I was watching something that was related to Doctor Who. Because it doesn't, it's not really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially since K-9 is so absent in this.
And it's so like, different as well in many ways.
What do you think, what do you guys think about the choice to have K-9 flying around in this show?
He flies now. we're required to put that joke in every episode of this.
Every
point,
week,
you know?
Yeah. I don't mind. I honestly don't mind him flying. I mean, it's, you know, it looks a bit naff. The CGI looks a bit naff, but that's.
I thought it was okay actually when they could afford a shot of it. I thought it looked decent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just in terms of production practicalities, it's a good call because you can put him in more scenes.
Yeah, they had a lot of issues in Classic Who with the terrain and stuff, didn't they?
Yeah, I would not be surprised if Bob Baker's first sentence out of his mouth was, okay, he flies now, he can be in any scene, please, please do not make it a purely practical prop.
Yeah.
That was his one condition, yeah.
Well, I don't think we saw K-9 rolling along the floor at all. He's like either on the desk with the professor or he's flying around.
That's because this episode had no money whatsoever.
he's kind of out of action a little bit for a lot of it, which is something that we've actually seen almost every week. That almost every week, I guess, because K-9 could solve the plot too fast, he gets kind what's the word, sort of incapacitated or something early on.
He's gotten blown up. He got really high that one time.
Yep, all of this happened.
K-9 got high?
Yes.
What have I missed?
And there was so one where he was a self-confessed murderer. That was a good week.
Yes, that was amazing.
Just dangling all these tidbits in front of you.
Have I been witness to a basically competent but much less interesting episode of K-9?
Yes,
I mean, kind of. Yeah, this is maybe the less. this is maybe the least mad one. Would you say, Kevin?
Yeah, this is definitely. There's no like drag queens getting broken out of space prison. There's no fart jokes.
Stop
there's no exploding beans.
But no, I did find it kind of boring, I have to say.
Yeah, that's fair. It's a very predictable. Like you said, the plot structure, the formula is very sort of okay. Yeah, so she's in the school and they're turning them all into zombies doing obedient population stuff. He tries to break in. There's some, fairly generic flirting happens and that's kind of it.
And I have to say, the resolution and one other moment, I thought it really dropped the ball and it felt like it ran out of time and money and just sort of raced to beats it didn't earn.
I would agree, which to be fair is a common Doctor Who problem.
Yeah.
So it's not, I'm not going to hold that against it.
But the one I will hold against it is the beat where Georgie does agree to get the mind control bracelet put on her, where because Starkey has just been flirted at by the protester turned pretty zombie, he's all obsessed with her. And out of a weird sort of jealousy and feeling of inadequacy thing, she puts the bracelet on. And she is too smart for that.
I didn't really understand why she was choosing to do that.
It's the moment where they're trying to glue together the kind of St. Trinian's Mean Girls thing and the fascist state thing least works, because you can do somebody giving into peer pressure when it's a really dumb thing, like kind of, I don't know, well, I can't think of a good example which shows you how much of a rebellious teen I was, but you can do somebody giving into peer pressure about that, or you can do something that is, she's choosing to buy into this awful system, knowing she will be controlled. But those are two very, very different, almost kind of conflicting things.
I mean, the easier character answer would have just been for her to agree to do it to try and prove herself, thinking she's stronger than it, thinking that she'll make an investigation breakthrough by doing it. If they'd done it that way, and that would have taken one other scene, just modify an existing scene to that, it would have worked well.
Yeah, that's quite Clara Oswald energy, isn't it?
I can see Georgie being a child Clara Oswald. We've been comparing her to Hermione, but...
We've been saying, we were talking about the accents earlier, and this is my thing, I have to try and get in every week. But I've been saying every week that she's trying to do an Emma Watson impression. And that's how she lands on the accent, I think. She's obviously just going straight for Emma Watson.
I think that's fair, and she does a relatively good job.
Yeah.
And I actually found the most entertaining aspect of this was the bad acting. particularly of the guy who plays Drake. And I think I had my mind started to wander because I'm a creative person. I know a lot of actors. I know a lot of people who've tried to get into professional acting. And it's very, very difficult. And even with kind of small-scale productions like this, there's tough competition for these parts. And I was just... racking my brains at how somebody that bad at acting can even get a role, because I personally know 50 or 60 people who are better at acting than him. And then I was trying to work it out and I was thinking, well, actually his accent was one of the worst in the cast. And you can tell he's really concentrating on it and he's over enunciating because he thinks that's what British people do. and I think it's distracting him, and that is the Tosin Cole problem. Mm. In that, if an actor is focusing too hard on an accent, then they can't do the acting. So I would be interested to see him. I mean, he's never going to be he's never going to be Dustin Hoffman or Laurence Olivier, but I would be interested to see him in something where he's doing his natural Australian accent, because I imagine he would be a better actor in that.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I also wonder if a part of it, and this isn't to kind of defend the actor at all, but is just the tonal weirdness, maybe, that I don't know how well the directors of the show in general have got a handle on what the tone is always supposed to be. And this is also a writing maybe failure.
I mean, I thought, obviously it was cheesy, but any decent actor should be able to pull off that kind of scenery chewing villainous stuff.
Yeah. Crushing his little cane thing or whatever it was he had.
Especially under the guidance of a director we know is this good.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Well, there's a little bit of future world building that comes in there, and that is something that we have touched on a little bit in other episodes. Because, Molly, you won't know this, but this stuff is all set in 2050.
You might know this on Wikipedia. Yeah, I had a little, snoop. Yeah.
Fair enough. So it's all set in 2050, and a previous episode has kind of established that there are these creatures coming through from the 26th century who are trying to affect the future development of Earth's climate and kind of freeze it over.
There's a time travel aspect.
Yeah, there is, which doesn't come into play here, but they do talk about the great cataclysm that's sort of obviously happened between now and 2050.
I did hear that, and I did wonder, is that a bit of world building?
Yeah. Well, they talk about sea levels rising and melting ice caps and things, so, you know, maybe that'll come into play as part of the broader arc stuff, I don't know, which is sort of teetering on the edge of being
it might be. I honestly didn't even think about that connection. I was too busy thinking, oh, this writer seems to have actual things to say, so she's actually stopping the plot to actually have some real interesting politics. That's refreshing.
2050 is quite soon, isn't it? Brave to set it that near in the future. How does this line up with Doctor Who's depictions of 2050? Do either of us know?
But, I mean, you know, I guess the obvious answer is it's not even trying to fit in with the Doctor Who universe, because it can't make any direct references anyway.
No.
So.
But it is supposed to be K-9 Mark I, isn't it? Or so says Bob Baker, right?
Well, I think, strictly speaking, it's K-9 Mark II because he's regenerated at the start.
We could call him K-9 Mark II. On my podcast, we had a running joke where we talked about the Australian K-9 as the F-boy K-9, because we thought that, knowing nothing about him and having never seen the show, we thought he gave a vibe of that he was an F-boy. What do you guys think about that, with more knowledge of him?
There are other episodes where he said things like, you know, oh, I thought you had no friends, to, you know, a character like Starkey.
That's right.
He has said that he has been a bit of a insert profanity here.
So what you're saying is he should have been at the Mean Girl school.
Yes, he's like a sort of a Russell Cain figure or something like that.
That would improve the show a lot if he'd gone to the
Mean Girl. Just K-9 going around commenting on the other girl's hair, you know. Where did you get your nails done?
But that would be better.
I think it would be better, yeah. John Leeson's back in this. And I guess I knew that, but when I heard him and I saw his name appear in the credits, I was like, oh, of course it's John Leeson. I mean, they could have recast it, couldn't they? But they chose not to. What do you think about John Leeson in this?
I mean, I guess to an extent he's kind of doing the same sort of work he always does. It's just that often the dialogue sounds not very familiar or true to the K-9 that we know.
Yeah.
There was one other thing that you could say is a bit yikesy about this episode, which is the detail that Drake, the cartoon baddie, is kind of controlling how suggestive or not the girls are. Like, that feels quite...
Oh my god, yeah!
Yeah, he's raising the high-pitchedness of their laughs and all this kind of stuff, and like how the... I mean,
that
okay,
is odd, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird. It's a weird beat for a kid's show.
That's made my skin crawl. Yeah, no, I don't like that. Yeah, I did wonder whether there was a little bit of underhanded misogyny at play, just in terms of as soon as the girls were under mind control, they became these sort of hyper-feminine archetypes who were, you know, without being weird about it, more sexually minded, I guess.
And the title and as think, well, Sirens.
Right, and I think in 2010, we were in an era where it was seen as, you know, seen as undesirable for women to embrace their femininity or, you know, being this sort of bookish, not like other girls type of girl was positioned in a lot of fiction as the right choice. Do you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the Hermione and et cetera, et cetera.
The Hermione, yeah, yeah. Did this ever air in the UK?
It did in 2010. I think it was actually, they aired them straight after episodes of Series 5, which is kind of hilarious.
That's brave, isn't it? That is brave. Yes.
From like Beast Below's. Oh, literally, actually, this episode was the same day as Beast Below. So you go from, you know, Beast Below's vision of a dystopian state to K-9's.
No.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh. What channel was it on?
Brutal.
Do we know?
Is it Disney XD?
Disney XD. So basically a channel nobody has got.
Nobody has, yeah, exactly.
Well, a channel that, like, you know, some middle-class people had on their cable box, but I've never had Disney XD in my life.
No.
Wow.
So it did not make much of a splash. I think it then aired in Australia after that, which is also a bit weird. The broadcast schedule was all over the place.
And it did it only do one season?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, like, quite a long season.
Yes. Yeah.
Gosh. And then what's the story with Timequake? Or have we not touched on that yet on this podcast?
It's never going to happen.
Do you think it's never going to happen? Come on, Kevin. Don't be cynical.
We did talk a little bit about it last week. They said it's going to happen. Or in our previous one. But, it was 2017 they announced it, I think, if I got my dates right.
No, it was 2017 they announced it to release in.
Oh, brilliant. Even better. and then,
it was announced in 2015, I think.
Yeah, yeah, to come out in 2017. And then all this
Which
kind
is
of,
now
you know,
almost 8 years ago.
Yeah. they have said that when Bob Baker passed away, they did say that he had recently completed scripts for a new K-9 TV series and film that they are hoping to continue with. So, you know, whether those will get made kind of 20 years after this first series,
I
don't know.
Though? Because I think surely, like, Bob Baker was the only person keeping this dream alive, right? Nobody's going to pick up the mantle from him. I don't know. Well, if you suddenly came into ownership of the copyright of to the K-9 character and you had to use it, what do you think is the best? You know, because this, I don't know whether this show is the best place for that character.
Mm.
What do you think would be the best use for that character?
Support.
Yeah.
I think he's only ever been good at support.
He can't be.
So the supporting character in something else.
Sarah Jane Adventures, basically. Something like that. Yeah. There needs to be another key anchoring idea or character.
I mean, if you really wanted to go wild, it would be fun to put him in more of a adult comedy series with more of like a Suicide Squad, Peacemaker kind of vibe.
Yeah.
I think he could be really funny as a sidekick in that, but he's only ever going to be the sidekick. He's just not a lead.
But what about if they were, if it was a Saturday morning cartoon and they're all robot animals and K-9 is sort of in a team with other robot animals and all the characters are anthropomorphic robot animals? Would that work? Sort of like a Super Dogs vibe.
I could see it working, but I also feel like that would be even further from Doctor Who than this is.
Oh my God, so far from Doctor Who. Yeah, so far from Doctor Who. Yeah. But it was interesting. I'm glad you made me watch this. It was an experience.
Made me being the operative word.
So do you think you'll be keeping Bob Baker's dream alive and tuning in for more?
I won't be. But you know what? I think if I was 8 years old, I'd stick another episode on. I'd have enjoyed it enough to keep watching. You know, which stuff is... like this used to air on Milkshake. And Kevin, you won't know what Milkshake was, but Tom, you probably do, right?
Yeah.
Did it bring boys to the yard?
So it was the... In the UK, we got five terrestrial... Well, it's all digital now, but when we were kids, we had five terrestrial channels. BBC One, BBC Two, ITV, Channel 4, and then Channel 5, which was like the last one to be added. And mostly shows... It has some of its own stuff, but it mostly shows... It imported things and reruns of other stuff. And their kids' programming was all under the umbrella brand of Milkshake. And it would happen in the morning, and loads of stuff on there was imported from Australia. And I can really imagine this show fitting in. It was like quite low budget, quite naff Australian kids' shows that they showed. Yeah. And I can imagine that if this was on Milkshake, I would have happily watched it each morning. And I'd have
thought it was quite good. I suppose if it would have been doing its job.
But I think I'd have enjoyed it when I was 7 or 8. Whereas I think this thinks it's aiming for a older audience than that.
Mm.
But I think you've hit something there where we don't really talk enough about nowadays, like the filler TV shows, the stuff that does its job to just exist on a schedule and does it well, because nowadays we live in the prestige TV streaming area where everything has to fight to seem like the most important thing out there. Whereas, there was a time when there was loads of shows like this, and there was a...
I remember a specific one from Milkshake that was Australian, and it's actually really similar to this. It was called Snobs. And
right.
Tom, do you know about this?
I do not.
Snobs was the name of a dog. And he was owned by a family of travellers. This traveller boy owned the dog, but he had a friendship, a sort of clandestine friendship, with a girl from the private school.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have adventures with the dog, and it was a sort of Romeo and Juliet thing where their families didn't want them to be friends, but they would solve mysteries with the dog. And even though the show was named after the dog, he was very much just the thing that brought everybody together, and not the focus of the show. And I guess I've kind of just described K9, haven't I? Mm.
That is weirdly similar, isn't it?
Yeah. My claim to fame is that I appeared on Milkshake.
Did you?
I guess it would have been 2004.
Is it on YouTube or Dailymotion somewhere? Can we?
It is on Dailymotion. You can't. I'd rather you didn't plug it because obviously I get dead named through the whole thing because I was 9 years old. But I make my own podcast. It is quite easy to find my dead name anyway. But yeah, that was my claim to fame. Yeah.
You were a Milkshaker.
All right, well, why don't we wrap that up and have you plug anything you actually do want to plug?
Right, so yeah, Galactic Yo-Yo still exists. I'm not making it at the moment, but there's loads of episodes with great guests on Spotify and SoundCloud and so on. I'm going to be making a new podcast very soon about music, and I'm not going to reveal any more because I've not launched it yet, but watch out for that. You can follow me on Twitter at Molly_Martian.
All right. Brilliant, Molly. Thank you very much. I, as ever, am Kevin and can be found on Twitter at ScribbleScript. And that Faction Paradox story I wrote is still rattling out there on the internet. And Tom.
And I'm, as usual, just manning the K9 Bingequake Twitter account, so you can follow that. That's pretty much it, to be honest. I'm not really using much other socials. Thank you very much, Molly, for joining us. This was an absolute delight. We're disappointed to hear you're not going to watch the rest, but we understand and respect your decision.
And we'll try to find a way to show you K9 confessing to murder sometime or something like that.
Yeah. I'd love that. Thanks both.
All right,
thank you. Bye.
Thank you.
You have been listening to K9 Bingequake with your hosts Tom Marshall, Kevin Bernard, and special guest Molly Martian. This episode, Creepy Catwalk Sachet, was recorded 28th December 2022 and was edited by Kevin Bernard. Theme music was composed by Jack Guidera. Thank you for listening, and repacking for a guilt trip, make sure to bring extra socks. You never know.